In a money-driven world, performing arts are subject to market rules, like any other field of production. Together with funding, be it public or private, performing arts receive a mandate to produce something of value. But what is value in the context of art? Is it the price we can get on the finished product? Or is there an intrinsic value of art for its own sake? And what is it? We feel the pressure to produce commodities, things to exchange for money, but with no tangible object to trade except the experiential moment of the now. Can the embodied performative event be a commodity? What monetary value can be placed on performance, and what work produces that value? Where can performance sit on the sliding scale between compliance and resistance?
Hello, I'm Angela Conquer, Artistic Director of Dance House in Melbourne.
And I'm Jana Perkovic. Welcome to the third season of Audio Stage, where we talk about value and price in the one performing art that produces no product to sell, and that is dance. My guest today is an extraordinary mind, Bojana Cvejić. Bojana is a performance theorist and maker, best known for an extraordinary scholarly contribution to dance and performance dramaturgical questions, a long-term collaborator with Jan Ritsema, with a doctorate from Kingston University, a researcher and teacher at PARTS in Brussels and SNDO in Amsterdam. Cvejić has also authored a number of important books, including a series of books on Anna Teresa de Kersmacher's choreographic practice. Her most recent book is Choreographing Problems, which looks at how choreography can engage in thought. Her current research focuses on social choreography, technologies and performances of the self, and time and rhythm in performance poetics and post-Fordist modes of production. Most recently, she was part of the 2016 Kier Choreographic Award jury in Australia, but this is not the only reason why she's joining us in conversation today.
Hi, Bojana. It's such a pleasure to have you with us today. I will start with a question which is indirectly linked to the Melbourne context. Very recently, we've had the pleasure of having here in Australia Xavier Leroy, and at Dance House, we have presented a very rich public program around his practice. I guess in an attempt to reiterate his enormously influential thinking in the field of choreography, but also to highlight his contribution to reinventing the relationship between the spectators, visitors, performers, and the production of subjectivities. And that really sparkled here a very much needed debate around notions of authorship and also what's kind of commonly called conceptual dance. And it made me think of your recent book, Choreographing Problems, where you speak very eloquently of these practices of thought, not only of Xavier's, but also of other choreographers such as Jonathan Burrows and Jerome Bells and Boris Sharmatz. And you speak of their methods of creation by way of problem posing, which have an incredible potential for engendering thought. And you rightfully stress that their work is uniquely able to desubjectivize and disobjectivize relations between movement, body, time, and of course the roles of author and of the spectator. I think you're right. These choreographers have contributed to a very distinct type of authorship. And I would like to ask you to speak a little bit more about this kind of authorship in a context where, if we look closely, the word doesn't necessarily prevail over movement, as we may think or as we may expect. And there is absolutely no dogmatic prohibition of physicality. What's interesting here, I would say, is that they generate some sort of new practices of capturing other materialities of movement. Would you be able to speak a little bit more about that?
And as you're doing it, maybe if you can explain what it means to desubjectivize movement, body and time?
I think that the authors that you have mentioned, the choreographers you have mentioned, contributed to a change that has happened in the last 2 decades, a certain turn from choreography understood as the composition of movement in space, of bodies in time and space, very close to craftsmanship, to mastery of movement, towards something that I would refer to as the politics of authorship, or what in French cinema of the new wave was referred to as politique des auteurs. which means in this case, almost half a century later, taking into account the conditions and the modes of production of work. And this has been also addressed and criticized as conceptual dance, as conceptual methodologies that choreographers like Xavier Leroy or Jérôme Bell had affinity for. And it was a much debated issue whether conceptual dance dematerializes dance from the bodies and movements. And I think that debate is about 10 years old. Fortunately, that chapter has been closed, in my view, in my assessment, because bodies, movement, thought abound in dance created by these choreographers. So I thought it was an unjust accusation to claim that, and it was also some kind of a defensive reaction around 2000s that somehow the bodies and movement was missing. But to affirm another politics of authorship means trying to control the conditions and circumstances in which also value is produced. And this is something that I think Leroy has been conscious of since the beginning, since the end of 90s, when he entered, let's say, the international scene of dance.
When you say that Leroy at that point in the late 90s reconceptualized value in performance, what do you mean specifically?
Well, I remember that a collective project that he initiated in 97, 98, called Extensions, meant involving around all in all 40 artists coming from different disciplines, not only dance, and spending daytime, some kind of 7-8 French working hours, rehearsing and performing at the same time and opening the doors for an audience to join when they pleased, in order to somehow bypass this event economy. So there was this question, what is the difference between the process and the product? And at that point, it was important to claim the production, the process, as the work and as the performance. And it was also a continuation of the thought from Yvonne Rainer's continuous project Altered Daily, where different modes of production in performance, what does it mean to prepare work, to perform it with in certain style, with certain competence, and so on. And to turn it into a more, let's say, a processual duration, which is what Extensions did in 98. Later in 2003, this whole process that happened in few occasions involving a different number of artists culminated in a performance called Project. And that was, let's say, an ironic title, that the performance was called Project and it involved one aspect of the work that they had been developing over years, which is games. And in these games, the way that individuals engaged also produced a certain and presented a certain kind of being and working together on stage, but that time signed under one author, single author, being Xavier Leroy.
Well, I'd pick you up on what you have just said about the politics of authorship, and I think you also highlight something very interesting in when you speak about these choreographers, is that this is a practice where they do it alone, and it's not collaborative. And God knows that we are in a now in a whole interrogation: what's authorship? Is authorship dead? Is it the time, or has it always been the time for a collaborative, co-creating. Would you like to maybe talk a little bit more about this politics of authorship and how come this practice is, I guess it's individual, it's related to the individual quest, I would say?
It seems that the debate on the death of the author that happened in French theory in the 80s came quite late in dance and performance. And I would say that, for instance, the exchanges that went on between Jérôme Bel and Xavier Leroy, Jérôme Bel, who commissioned a piece that he owned, that he signed, but that was entirely done by Xavier Leroy and was called Xavier Leroy, was, let's say, a kind of gamey contribution to that debate. But there was a moment where collaboration against collectivity was pitted, and the fact that contemporary dance didn't develop in collectives but in a single authorship. But this single authorship changed from what we know from the production model of companies under the great author in the 80s, such as Andrés de Kesmaeker, or a younger exponent of that mode would be Meg Stewart. I also remember the work that I've participated in, initiated by the Slovene theater director Emil Hrvatin. It's called Collect If. That was the title of the work. And we gathered performers, dancers who participated in the companies and were somehow marked by the great authors being Jan Fabre, Meg Stewart, and Teresa de Kesmaeker. And we wanted to explore collectivity, the state of collectivity with them, them being somehow, I would say, not damaged goods, but performers who had a profile that was associated with the choreographer that they had worked for. And that was an interesting exploration, in the sense that it showed that it's quite difficult to form a collective with such a quest of how to be an ad hoc group and work collectively. There's always a need to attribute authorship to the one who initiates the project. And so I would say that the whole debate on authorship in post-Fordist capitalism, where teamwork is the basis of production, so cooperation is indispensable, it's necessary, and it's a given. So how to recognize it and extend it so that the authorship in terms of artistic credits would be shared? And I don't think that we have found and established a satisfying model, because still these companies under great authors continue to work more and more in a post-Fordist fashion, relying much more on collaboration. But then the dancers are signed as the creative artists that have contributed to the making of the choreography. And it is also that I would say that the institutional market fosters the model of single authorship. So finally, it's not only that the works of dance are commodities, it's the artists are commodities. It's somehow it's more of a value which artists one has on their program than what is the work. And also, this is part of yet another shift from, I would say, investment into production to managing reception of work, and especially position. And she has a considerable influence on dance practitioners, especially in the way that she has, autonomized dance as a practice. I'm not sure if the problem lies there. I think from the point of view of academic scholarship, historians of dance have posed the question of how many names of dancers do actually enter the history. This is not an insignificant question. Now, when it comes to credits and sharing artistic authorship, and that's separated also from ownership, because there's also the economic aspect of and how much an employed, hired dancer can control the conditions of their work. I think that that is not to be underestimated, especially because with conceptual procedures, the performers become more dispensable and exchangeable. So also the material that is being produced is in some way also outsourced. I mean, if the places of production, like werkplaatsen, as we call them in Dutch here, also small-scale houses disappear because cultural policy is such that it invests primarily in presentation, circulation, reception, then I also think that less attention is paid to how things are made. And I'm not being nostalgic or reactionary or wanting to revalorize craftsmanship, but there is something to the, let's say, production of dance which involves a body and involves a training. And if that side is marginalized, as it tends to be, because it's probably economically more not sustainable. I don't want to say sustainable. It's more feasible for producers. Then I think the dancers are in an even worse position. They're becoming even more anonymous. If you go to see the large spectacles and events involving dance and choreography in museums, that is the case. That is more the case than when you go in a theater and you have a program with a... I think that all competences must be acknowledged I think that there is an interaction between the how and the what. So it's a part of a general de-skilling. And again, I'm not, let's say, advocating that we have to go back to disciplinary organization of education, training, from ballet on, but... it's incredible that in this part of this de-skilling, people lose skills or they don't invest in skills, and that's also somehow cutting with history and let's say investing everything in novelty and in conceptual novelty. But it's also something to say that speaking of authorship, that there's such a proliferation of dance artists who call themselves or are regarded as choreographers or as authors nowadays. And so this concentration in so-called great authors from the 80s or 90s has dissolved also thanks to the booming infrastructures of dance and in education as well. So it's that's why I think that there is really a shift towards these single authors as commodities even more than performances, because how many performances will they even get to make, because the budgets are getting smaller, smaller co-production fees. I think that we are in an acceleration process where there are more and more individuals coming out of schools across Europe and the world. And the resources have not expanded in order to really invest in the production on the scale that we have had. So works are made for a shorter time, and they tend to be solos because also this younger generation choreographers don't have the means to hire many bodies. I'm sorry, I'm sounding very pessimistic.
No. Actually, it's a wonderful transition for my next question, because I'd like you to dwell a little bit more on these conditions of production, because, and to go maybe a little bit further in how it impacts on maybe the production of meaning as well, because we've recently had a publication, one of our issues, the latest issue of our publication was looking at how an arts funding system and a national cultural policy, or even like a local economic system, impacts or prescribes or determines the modes of production when artists make work, but also maybe, and this is where I think it gets interesting, to what extent it influences or impacts on the content and on the meaning. And I know that in some of your writings, you were looking at the small-scale production model, and you analyzed whether it was a symptom of the artist's flexible subjectivity in terms of the artist agreeing with the conditions and limitations of a non-commercial work, and then in that sense, kind of diminishing his or her independence. So I'm wondering what are these lines where, the format becomes specific to the medium it explores? Because I'm seeing some very blatant similarities with the Australian context, where sometimes I think the production context can really enfeeble the artistic endeavor for many reasons. Would you like to talk a bit about that?
The last point you've made is something that I refer to as productional realism. Very often I find myself in theater and I can see that the work has been made in less than 2 months because there was not enough means to invest and to go further. And that's a pity, because you see that the possibilities have been undercut, foreclosed from the beginning. But to come to the meaning production and value entangled with meaning, I recall that and the book that you mentioned, the last one that I wrote, that it took me 6 years in a way to finalize that research and to publish it in a book, and to me it already belongs to the past, to history, because that kind of rigor and readiness to experiment and to lose audience is something that even those choreographers that I'm writing about are no longer prepared to do. Because the institutional market is fierce, the competition is such, it's a competition for attention, which is measured in audience figures. So, for instance, Untitled, the work that was anonymous for a while and unprecedented as such, and later on the authorship was revealed and attributed to Xavier Leroy, was shown only in the places that co-produced it, and was met with considerable resistance and hostility of the audience, but around the meaning. What is it about? What does it want from us? Why are we in this dark place where we don't understand how we should explore the stage, and how our exploration of the stage, literally our gaze extended with the battery lamps that we direct onto the stage, reveals that there are some animate and inanimate figures in indiscernible movement. How are we to be together with this event, and is this an event? And it was an interesting discussion that went on. It was part of the performance shown in Berlin, in Valenciennes, in France, and so on. But that really belongs to past. It was in 2005, so it's about 10 years ago. I don't think that theaters will afford that kind of questioning and audience participation in a way where audience won't be satisfied, will not go home with a reason why they came there in the first place. And in that particular case, it was curiosity that led them to see what is this nothing that has been advertised for us as nothing, and with no name that signs it and no title. Now, I think that to be even more pessimistic than in the previous answer, I could say that it is no longer self-evident that the dance will continue to be produced and presented as it has been. It has had a quite a young art discipline compared to others, somehow comparable with cinema, so the 20th century. And where are we now? Because I think that in mass culture and in a kind of general mainstream, pop mainstream, dancing body is much more currency than the dancing body live on a theater stage. It's already difficult to address contemporary audience living in the cities, public to attract them by theaters. So I find that it's becoming more elitist in a general populist turn in culture, which goes hand in hand with a kind of right-wing conservative governments with also conservative cultural policies. So certainly it will continue to exist, like contemporary music continues to exist even from the beginning of the 20th century, where there was a rift between popular music and contemporary music. But I find that it's how will it contribute? It seems like it is more in a position to react to mainstream and to defend itself against the mainstream and to make and try to make sense with the bodies. And I'm speaking from a position where I highly value this, but I can also put now a kind of pessimistic hat on and observe the audiences, and also from speaking to my students, who will probably know more about Beyoncé than about and Beyoncé's moves than about the history of dance, or will not even feel encouraged to enlist themselves in among the artists because they see that everything else is so much more powerful, and they feel overpowered. And it has to do with social network, social media. I remember that in, I think it was 2007-08, when YouTube videos became a way of exchanging bits of dance without being in the same place, so trying to have a collaboration at distance. And that there was a bet among dancers that it would, that if I place a video and call for responses, that this will elicit responses, and that potentially I can have millions of people. But what makes a video viral has probably very little to do with the intentions of a dance artist. So I think we have to deal with all that. We cannot shut ourselves to how let's say attention is distributed between mainstream and pop on the one hand and what we think is still valuable to do in cultural venues such as theaters and museums.
You talk at various points in your practice about the performance of self in that real kind of classical 20th century anthropological sense in which we perform our social identities quite physically by doing something again and again, and sort of shaping our physical selves. And you talk about how we perform labor, or rather by performing labor, we perform career, and through our performance of career, we perform our identity. And you connect that to the practice of dance, dancing, being a producer of dance. And you compare saying something like, I've done Vietnam to I've done the Paris Ballet Conservatory to the way you'd say, I've done Wall Street. You know, you've had that experience. And then you connect that to the sort of performances that we that are starting to sort of happen more and more now, in which individuals or sort of the general audience is enlisted to perform relatively ordinary ways of being in a choreographic performance work, which is authored by someone else. If you could unpack that a little bit, why you say at the end of that thought that that might lead to selfie fascism, quoting Lepecki.
If we agree with social anthropology that that the self is constructed and performed, and already in the 70s and 80s terms from theater and performance were utilized, but also we could say habitus of Pierre Bourdieu, and or even earlier, the beginning of the 20th century, Marcel Mauss and the techniques of the body. Let's say there's a long tradition of qualifying performances of the self in terms of theater, and perhaps nowadays even more choreography, because choreography stresses embodiment as an aspect of it. And what you've just mentioned in your question is to me linked to the idea that and I think that that's somehow a prevalent aesthetic regime of this performance of the self today, is that we experience the truth of being ourselves through the body, through how it feels, not through the consciousness, a consciousness being distorted by this or that ideology. We believe that we live in post-ideological times, but perhaps the ideology of individualism on which capitalism relies today needs the body to, on the one hand, confirm the success, the feeling of success on the one hand, and on the other hand also intensity as this proof of reality. So why I'm mentioning all this is that I've noticed that body systems and techniques developed in dance, particularly by dancers, have been exported into other domains, especially in business, and that are also part of the daily care of the self nowadays, much more than, for instance, psychotherapy used to be. So it's a kind of a pragmatic, hands-on approach to the self that through doing one may change one's sense of being. So I think it's extremely useful to develop a methodology or instruments coming from dance and to utilize them to describe the practices, experiences of the self in everyday life. And one other domain that I'm looking into is also extreme sports, and especially the link between extreme sports and adrenalized experiences that link with for instance, high-end business, where once you have lived a collapse in your career, and these careers are usually short-lived, about 7 years, for instance, on Wall Street, a lot of bankers redirect themselves, for instance, into extreme sports. And there's something that, it sounds banal in the sense of, yes, we know it. We know that it was first yoga, now it's more Pilates, now it's maybe the latest is the CrossFit, and why is CrossFit so popular? But I think that we can learn also about the conception of the subjectivity, contemporary subjectivity today, through that. And I link it to this experience of intensity and associating truth to this ontologized experience of the self, that harks back to modern dance, to Martha Graham, the body doesn't lie, the body can't lie. So I think that those are the links for me, and also what I'm observing is also the predominance of solo, solo dance and solo performance, which is in a way the most inexpensive and convenient format today, but also how this post-Fordist capitalism, the creative class is taught to perform themselves. And I have also friends, colleagues who earn their money from training in business performance rhetoric. And then the embodiment is very important, because that's what endows this performance with a kind of aesthetic component, and where it becomes artist-like, where the how even is more important than the effect that it has, or it's linked with the effect that it will have.
Mm-hmm. But how do we get to selfie fascism?
Oh, selfie fascism. It's a self expression, selfie expression, I think I use that term. Maybe selfie fascism is Andrea Lepecki. I believe that probably the worst development of participation in cultural policy is what we see with trying to measure and valorize the experience of museum visitors or recipients of art as individual selves, and selfies, as you know, are also debated a bit in museums, and how does that change the environment? Well, we're all a live experience, which we want, because that's more visceral and more intense, is immediately being recorded and circulated. And then also a place like Tate Modern, for instance, develops software that can measure experiences. So the immaterial value, the, let's say, imaginary property of your experience in a performance must be now quantified and quantifiable. And then, of course, Twitter is used, and different softwares that detect subjectivity in these expressions. But yes, that's what I think is the most grotesque effect of this policy.
The quote that I've isolated from one of your I don't know which book now, because I've read many things recently by you, but in one of them you say, you're asking, why has dance and specifically movement become a new metaphor for going beyond contract systems, structures, as models of theorizing subjectivity, art, society and politics? And you say movement operates from the middle of things, makes us step outside the predetermination of points and positions. It expresses the potential of moving relations. And I think it kind of summarizes beautifully what you have just said. When you speak about body autonomy, you beautifully reference Derrida, you know, and the dystopian question of time, of not being in the moment. And at some point you use this beautiful phrasing that I'm not sure I quite understand in which context would make sense. I mean, I understand, but I'd like to tell me if I'm wrong. When you speak on the, you talk about the conditions the body loses its sensibility of time. I wonder what those conditions are, what happens where the body loses its sensibility of time.
So speaking of self-performances, I think that we see it as choreography, but how we want, the performances of the self, let's say, want to hide that script, the structure. The one who excels at performing him herself is the one who is able to improvise or to dissimulate the contract or the structure. And to improvise etymologically comes from extempore, to go out of time. So this And that's probably the as you say, it's beautiful. It's a sublime experience for both the recipients of art, let's say, or and the artist, when we lose that pace, when we are able to step out of the of the temporality that is, let's say, habitual, and at the moment where you think that it's, I don't know, it's maybe about feeling eternity of a moment, of that instant, and I'm always wary of fetishizing this, because this is what improvisers talk about, and they're really searching for that moment of being taken by surprise. And sometimes it's only the surprise for them and not the surprise for us, because it's about reproducing the same formula. It doesn't mean that it doesn't happen, but I think that that is also something that motivates and is part of this charismatic subjectivity in performance. So yes, going out of time. I mean, going out of time can also happen in other ways. In the book, Choreographing Problems, I discuss at length this piece by Esther Salomon, Invisible, which is about an extremely slow movement, so slow that it's imperceptible, or that it's hallucinatory, where you have to look away and look back to be able to register change. Because it's the duration of the body is on a micro scale that that is happening, and that one has to be attuned or synchronize with that base. And I think that that's also going out of time, or just going in another region of temporality, which is what performance allows us to experiment with. But let's say this is one of the most radical works that was always divisive towards the audience. Half of them who stayed really, really enjoyed it, and the rest would leave after 20 minutes, understanding that these four women, these four bodies will move for 80 minutes in that pace, will be traveling 4.5 meters on stage. So who has patience for that?
Miriam Gurfink is very good at that as well. So I was saying that I was going to ask you a question that you ask yourself in a 2005 article, and I do hope that in the meantime you have formulated some answers. You were saying, again very poetically, what may be worth doing together in dance and performance vis-a-vis society today? What are those vital experiments, if any, that may inspire us to approach differently, you know, our moving and thinking body in relation to identity, belonging, knowledge, economies, and globalization? We were a little bit pessimistic at some point in this conversation, but not quite so much. And I do think there's a lot of hope there with the moving body. But what do you think we can still do together with dance and performance today?
We can experiment with being together, working together, also with some kind of trans-individuation, sharing that is that which is more than individual, that we have in excess, and that we don't need governments or other mediators to represent for us. But I think that such situations probably must be proposed by artists themselves, who could hijack the opportunities that are given in the art for that kind of encounter. And I do think that it happens in moments when the space is opened up. For instance, in museums, it happens more because the economy of time is different than in theaters, whether it's a staged event. I think that we have to reinforce or strengthen or recognize the strength of what has always been the case, but as a potentiality, especially in this time where of acceleration and of a lack of public space and public culture, and so I don't know. I'm very hopeful of square movements. What we have learned politically from Athens and from Syntagma Square, for instance. I can't say the same for Istanbul in a moment when Turkey is in turmoil. But I would say that that kind of being together is a social choreography where people take over functions that the state no longer can fulfill for them. And obviously I'm using now choreography in a very expanded sense as a kind of organization, but organization of complex processes. I think that choreographers are really the ones who have the capacity for that. They know what it means to organize dynamic processes which are heterogeneous and which are in movement, and so I think that various domains of human activity could be choreographed differently when people are empowered, and usually they are empowered in extreme deficiency, which is what is happening, for instance, at the moment in Greece, in Athens, and with the solidarity movement. So yes, I think solidarity, being together. I know that this is a very, very leftist answer, and it's looked down upon as weak compared to what actually has power or currency today. But I do think that this is underrepresented, and that it can be strengthened.
If that is the thing that you contrast with that selfie fascism, right, where you say how can we perform citizenship rather than self, the self, the selfie. So we're talking about that difference between agency, also performing our individual agency rather than performing our identity or our social identity.
I think that artists and lack political education, and it's something that we could be included in the so many performance programs nowadays that that are burgeoning all over. So I think it's unclear to everyone what it means to be a citizen. Also amongst so many clandestine status of immigration, asylum seekers, refugees, and so on. But also this sense of belonging and entitlement, or claiming what belongs, or what one could be part of decision-making process is. In 2014, I collaborated with Christine de Smet in Tate Modern and Turbine Hall. We organized a series of experiments in that space, in that open space, under the title of Spatial Confessions. And we asked the audience, the visitors, to join us in 5-minute-long experiments where we would pose questions and the answer would be a movement. And they were, the movements would result in shapes that would redistribute the people in the space. So looking from above, that would be another, let's say, configuration pattern, ornament, let's say, mass ornament. And it was quite interesting to see how people joined the more political questions were posed, which was also at that time a question of Scotland and separating from UK, all the questions around London, and so on. It would be interesting to repeat the same experiment now after Brexit. But it was also, let's say, probing the state of citizenship of the visitors who are there to see some art and perhaps even shop more and kind of hang out in the space, taking refuge from the rain. So I think this question of citizenship is to try to increase the political consciousness of being a subject in a society.
Thank you so much for being here with us today, Buena.
Thank you. for this conversation.
Thank you, Bojana.
Our guest today was scholar and dramaturg Bojana Cvejić. This episode of Audio Stage was produced by Bethany Atkinson Quinton and recorded with the help of Carl Corcoran in real time between Brussels and Melbourne using all the technology available. You can find us on iTunes or through our website audiostage.guerrillasemiotics.com. So stay tuned as we continue to discuss the value and price of dance.